Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the program for the 5th of March 2019, which in the Hebrew calendar is the 28th of Adar 1, 5779. I am Walter Bingham. Today you will hear another in the series of pre-election interviews with leading personalities of the political parties that are hoping to make it to the Knesset. This week it's the well-known writer and columnist Caroline Glick, but more a little later. It's been a momentous week in world politics. The long-expected second summit between President Trump and the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has finally taken place. The agreed location was Hanoi, the capital city of Vietnam. From the American point of view, that was the first of the expected successes of their carrot-and-stick diplomacy. While sanctions are still in place, President Trump offered a large measure of economic help to North Korea if they begin in earnest their denuclearization program as discussed at the first summit. So, what was for the U.S. the significance of Hanoi? Well, after the almost total destruction of Vietnam's economy during the 21-year-long conflict from 1954 until 1975, that country has, with American help, recovered. Although a one-party communist state, it has one of Southeast Asia's fastest-growing economies and has set its sight on becoming a developed nation by 2020. That, it was suggested, could also be the future of North Korea. It seems that the American team was not well enough prepared and that they possibly gave the wrong signals of the extent of their plans to help the Korean economy at this early stage. That was, in my view, misread by the North Korean president, Kim Jong-un, who requested a total lifting of sanctions before he would continue with the destruction of his nuclear facilities. The lifting of sanctions at this point was not part of the American plan, and it was clear that President Kim has overplayed his hand and he would have lost faith if he had retracted. So Trump decided that he needs to give the North Korean leader more time to rethink his intentions and terminated the meeting. It is hoped that a further summit will be scheduled in the not-too-distant future at which more progress could be achieved. The next big test for President Trump's negotiating skills will be the even more trumpeted deal of the century, the Palestinian-Israeli peace plan that is scheduled to be published after Israel's election, which takes place on April the 9th, and perhaps even before the formation of a government.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Walter Bingham.
The peace plan to be published after Israel's election and perhaps even before the formation of a government, which may have an influence on that task and perhaps even on the president's choice, because he is the authority to delegate who should form a viable coalition government. Having failed in Hanoi, probably much to his annoyance because it dented his reputation as master negotiator, it is obvious that President Trump will want to avoid another defeat and will instruct his team to use every trick in the book, including veiled threats, to achieve compliance. That's why it is of the utmost importance to have a government that can and will withstand any plan that affects the weakening of our security by manipulation of borders, which has already been hinted at by Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor and one of the plan's architects. Internally, too, American politics are experiencing a shunt to the left. Some of the freshmen in the now Democrat-controlled House of Representatives in the Congress are trying to exert influence by publishing their socialist ideas. For instance, the economically illiterate Democrat representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez caused quite a stir with her Green New Deal, which required upgrading every building in the country and mode of transportation, as well as the entire power grid, to avoid economic and climate disaster. The deal aims to establish a new social contract for America in line with the economical and ecological realities of the 21st century, they claim. All this in 12 years to transform the U.S. economy and society to preserve the staple climate that human civilization depended on millennia, they say. Accordingly, politicians have a choice to either find the courage to stand up to the fossil fuel billionaires who bankroll both parties, or condemn millions of people to a future without the livable planet human civilization has depended on for millennia. The Green New Deal includes guarantee of income for Americans unable or unwilling to work. What a great prescription for making sure that the majority of people become unwilling to work. They aim to establish liberal priorities as broad as free housing and vegetarianism. Clean air, to the extent of abolishing cows because they're flatulent, poisons the environment. And another plan calls for making airplanes obsolete and investing massively in high-speed rail lines. As all reliance on fossil fuels and nuclear power are to be abolished, I assume that the trains will run on electricity. So how would they produce enough to run their proposed high-speed rail service without nuclear or fossil fuel? Or will the beautiful landscape be covered all over by wind turbines? That should surely also count as destroying the environment. Answering her critics, Ocasio-Cortez said that when former President John F. Kennedy said he'd put a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s, people also said it was impossible. What a stupid comparison. All the major Democratic presidential contenders for 2020 say they back the idea. God help America. That's if their slogan "In God We Trust" still holds. In some U.S. states, such stickers are actually prohibited. The American dream is a national ethos of the United States, the set of ideals in which freedom includes the opportunity for success and prosperity, as well as an upward social mobility for the family and children, achieved through hard work in a society with few barriers. The new trend towards socialism negates these ideals because socialism does not create wealth. Capitalism does. Socialism can only exist after capitalism has created the wealth so that they can use it to redistribute. And socialism never lasts, but must collapse when the masses become impoverished. There are many examples. The latest is, of course, Venezuela. Another Democrat freshman in the House is the vociferous Somali-born Ilhan Omar. She and her colleague Rashida Tlaib are the first Muslim women elected to Congress. Not surprisingly, Omar's pet subject is making vile anti-Semitic comments like the one she made at a town hall event in Washington, D.C., where she suggested that Israel demands allegiance from American lawmakers. Or, referring to Jews in America, she said, "I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it's okay for people to push the allegiance to a foreign country." APAC tweeted, "The charge of dual loyalty not only raises the ominous specter of classic antisemitism, but it's also deeply insulting to the millions upon millions of patriotic Americans, Jewish and non-Jewish, who stand by our democratic ally, Israel." A big event in Israel was the announcement that Attorney General Mandelblit has decided to indict Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for fraud, bribes, and breach of trust in 3 of the 4 cases of which he stood accused. The Prime Minister claims total innocence and a preliminary hearing has to be scheduled. The hearing, which can be either a written exchange or in person, is a lengthy month-long process that won't fit into the time frame before the April 9th general election. Such hearings give the legal team of the person accused the chance to be heard before state prosecutors in order to dispute and refute any of the evidence and analysis in the report that accompanies the state's decision to indict. It is dependent on the outcome whether an indictment would be entered. The prosecution said Netanyahu knew all about this, including gifts to Sarah, his wife, which he denied. In the country, there is now a discussion if it is right for Netanyahu to continue. Several opposition Knesset members, party leaders, and demonstrators in Tel Aviv have asked for his resignation, although in Israel, as in all other democracies, there is a presumption of innocence until proved guilty, and like all other laws, that section of the law also applies to the highest officers in the land. The chief legal officer of the Movement for Quality Government in Israel, Tomer Naor, is on the telephone to me from his office and comments in detail on the announcement, the cases to be indicted, and their potential influence on the outcome of the election.
It's the second time in 10 years the Attorney General is indicted Prime Minister in Israel, even though this time he's indicted over a hearing and still not a final decision. We're proud of it because Israel shows again that it fights corruption within it. We're not afraid to send two prime ministers, one to the jail. The second one is probably going to be indicted for severe accusations. Let's start from the beginning. So the first case out of three, and for Netanyahu cases, they just chose randomly 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 for the submarine case and 4,000 for the Bezekuala case. So basically, case 1,000 begins in the year of 2016. Investigation against Netanyahu, both Benjamin Netanyahu and Sarah Netanyahu, his wife. And the suspicious is that Netanyahu, for many years, received presents from his so-called friend, Arnon Milchan, which is an Israeli businessman, a famous producer in the United States, giving him cigars and champagne for his wife. Every month there is a special big delivery of champagne and cigars and other gifts. All together in 10 years sums up in more than 1 million shekel. And in return, the suspicion says that Netanyahu gave benefits to his friend Arnon Milchan. He helped him with tax breaks. He helped him with getting a visa to enter into the United States of America. Important to say that Netanyahu, many times, says that, well, Arnon Milchan is my friend. Aren't you receiving gifts from your friend? And it's important to say that at the moment, the Attorney General decided that there is no bribery here. Arnon Milchan setting free. He was first investigated also for giving bribery money and Netanyahu for receiving bribery, and not money, of course, for benefits and the gift. But today, the Attorney General says, basically, there is no bribe in here. Yet, there is a breach of trust, which is a lower accusation. Breach of trust by Netanyahu. Basically, Arnon Milchan is now set free, and the lower case out of the three cases. So that's the first one. The second one goes deep into the history. They call it the Yediot Achronot case. About 12 years ago, there's a new newspaper comes in Israel. His name is Israel Hayom. It's funded by Sheldon Adelson, which is one of Netanyahu's big supporters, sponsors to his campaign. And for many years, Netanyahu is accused, basically, of having his own newspaper. Now, Israel Hayom is handed for free, while the biggest newspaper at the time in Israel, Yediot Achronot, cost money. And in the year of 2014, a group of parliament members, both from coalition and from the opposition, starts to promote a new law. They call it the nickname of Israel Hayom law. It says one thing, basically, it will be prohibited in Israel to give a newspaper for free, which means Israel Hayom will have to start charging money. And Netanyahu goes against this law at the time. He failed. This law goes for first round out of three rounds within the Knesset before approving. A year later, the police find records of secret conversation between Netanyahu and the publisher of Yediot Achronot, Arnon Moses. And within those conversations, Netanyahu basically is offering the publisher of Yediot Achronot to take care of this Israel Hayom law, to promote it as well, and by doing that, support the business interests of Yediot Achronot, of Noni Moses, and return for positive covering. Yediot Achronot was one of the biggest opponents to Netanyahu, very negative covering, and very positive covering to his political rival. Apparently, all this time, there was a secret meeting between Netanyahu and the publisher of Yediot Achronot, offering Netanyahu positive covering. They used the term, turn away the sheep, and start giving you positive covering. Again, in return of Netanyahu will promote the Israel Hayom law. And in this case, again, there's no accusation for bribe, yet there's an accusation for fraud and for breach of trust for Netanyahu. the Attorney General today basically announced that there is no bribe and there is no other suspect in this case, not Arnon Moses, only Netanyahu, and he's not accused for bribe, yet he accused for fraud and for breach of trust. That's the second case. The third case is the case 4000, the Wala Bezek case. Bezek is one of Israel's largest communication companies, basically parallel to AT&T in the United States. It's a big monopoly, for many years controls the phone lines in Israel, controls some of the companies within the cell phone businesses. And for many years, the Minister of Communication are talking about promoting a big reform within the market of communication, called the Bezek reform. In the year of 2015, Netanyahu goes for an election.
Stay tuned to hear what happens next.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Tamar, she's sassy.
She's smart.
She's funny.
But she's also a real Jewish mother.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tamar Yonah. And yes, I can be all of those things. But at Israel News Talk Radio, I'm here to bring you the news stories and guests that you may not hear anywhere else. Join me live on air Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays for the most unique and bold talk radio in Israel.
The Tamar Yonah Show. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
In the year 2015, Netanyahu goes for an election. He wins his 30 mandate. He decides to take the Minister of Communication as well. So he's the Prime Minister and the Minister of Communication. And all his political colleagues, all the heads of parties that goes with him into the coalition, into the government, he made them sign a contract that basically said that any law that has to do with communication, with media, etc. in Israel has to go first through him. And he has a veto right on any law. But slowly Netanyahu starts to make changes within the communication offices. One of the first things he's doing, he fired the CEO of the Office of Communication, a CEO that's from the private sector, highly appreciated CEO, who was supposed to lead the reform in Bezek. Instead of him, he brings one of his political, we call it in Hebrew, machel, a person that grew up in the Likud. His name is Shlomo Filbel, and he brings him to be the CEO of the communication office. The first thing they both do is they cancel the reform with Bezek. First they cancel the reform, and later on they approve Bezek to purchase Israel's satellite broadcasting company called Yes. Again, a lot of eyebrows raised in Israel, so a lot of economic journalists don't understand why Netanyahu chose to do that. But another thing happened in those years.
Shaul Elovich,
who is the head of Bezek Group, also owns a broadcasting and media website called Wala. And during those years, Netanyahu started getting a very positive covering in Wala, also his wife, with very negative covering to his political rivals, especially Naftali Bennett, Ayelet Shaked, the head of Habayit HaYehudi party, which is, by the way, within the government, within the coalition. And about a year and a half ago, investigation begins against Netanyahu. They said that they have hidden records of the person who used to be the CEO of talking to his publisher, and also with the head of the Bezek Group, Shaul Alovich, getting orders from Benjamin Netanyahu to give him positive covering.
In Wala?
In return of Netanyahu taking care of the business interests of Bezek Group, of Alovich, basically. All those moves that Netanyahu did as the Minister of Communication was arguably in return for his covering in Wala website. In this case, Netanyahu is accused and is going to be indicted for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Shaul Alovich is also going to be indicted for giving bribery money. He's also going to be indicted for money laundering and for another few felonies. Supposed to be the biggest case. They have a lot of hidden records. Shlomo Filbel, who used to be Netanyahu's secret person, used to be the CEO of the office, is now a witness for the State of Israel. Nir Hefetz, who used to be the spokesman of Sara Netanyahu and Benjamin Netanyahu, and arguably the messages between Netanyahu to Alovich, is also a state witness for the State of Israel. And from what we hear, that's the strongest case against Netanyahu, and there's not a lot of chances for him to get out of it. We're heading towards an election in Israel. The street in Israel is divided between two opinions. The first one says that it's not the right democratic thing to do at the moment to announce those accusations. First, because we're right before the election, and second, because it's not the final accusation. It's still going to be hearing for Netanyahu. Now, two things about that. First, it's important to understand how the criminal procedure works in Israel. In order to get to the point that the Attorney General decided to indict you under a hearing, the police have to recommend, and then it goes to the Attorney General, and he investigates for another year. And when he decides to indict you, it's not the first thing or not the second thing you do. It's like the third part of the chain, and before going to court. The second thing, and that's already my political commentator, we say that there is no good time to press in charges or indictment against the prime minister, neither before or after the election. And if we're looking through a democratic eye, we're saying that now before the election, it's the right of the public to know and to hear the accusations. Also knowing, by the way, that there's going to be a hearing and there is a chance that Netanyahu can set free after a hearing. By the way, not a big chance, especially when you look at the case of 4,000. But by law, indictment under hearing is not a final indictment. Therefore, he can stand as a prime minister. He can get elected. If after the hearing, a decision of the attorney general will be final, he still can be a prime minister under the Israeli law. Yet at that time, the Supreme Court of Israel will probably interfere. We know that in the past, ministers that have been accused and indicted could not stay within the government under indictment. We wait and see what will happen with Netanyahu.
Of course, legally, as you explain, the prime minister can function. But morally, from my experience in the UK, anyone with even lesser accusation hanging over his head would resign. Should he not resign?
So if you ask me morally, as the Movement for Quality Government representative, I will say definitely. Unfortunately, in Israel, we say we lost the shame. We already saw it with Olmert. About 10 years ago, he kept blaming the prosecution, the attorney general, for trying to interfere with politics in Israel to take the prime minister down. Netanyahu took it to a whole new level. And in a very funny way, by the way, Netanyahu is now prime minister for 9 years. He basically nominated the chief of police, he nominated the attorney general, he nominated the head of prosecution. He nominated them all. It doesn't stop him from accusing them now of being left-wingers, of trying to bully him, of trying to interfere politics in Israel. And he has a lot of power. And that's very interesting, by the way, to say. Many people in Israel say that, even though he will argue that, but many people say that the Attorney General announcement might even stronger hit him in the coming election. There's a lot of people in Israel who believe that he is innocent, that this is all a big scheme of dark left-wing powers. And he's doing a very good propaganda promoting this. Unfortunately, in Israel, he will not resign from the shame or something. He will fight it until his last minute.
I'd be glad to hear your opinion. Write to Walter at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. And now to Israel's election politics that are hotting up. The deadline for registering parties and their lists of prospective Knesset members has passed, and we now know the names of all 40-plus parties and their leaders. By the way, a request to register a party in Israel requires the signature of at least 100 citizens. If you buy the Jerusalem Post on Fridays, you'll be in the company of hundreds or more who do so only to read the column by Caroline Click. She is a most knowledgeable commentator of Israeli affairs, and her column has appeared in that and other publications for many years. Recently, she exchanged her pen and paper, or computer as is most likely, for the chance to get a seat in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, as a member of the New Right Party, which in Hebrew is called Hayamin HaChadashah, at the forthcoming election, to put into practice what she's been advocating in her columns. Here is Caroline Click in a longer than usual edited version of a long conversation disclosing periods of her early years as you've never heard her, or rather read about before, and what moved her to join the New Right Party.
Because what I'm doing is asking you to vote for me, that maybe I should do something that I don't do in my writing very often, which is tell you a little bit about who I am and why it is that I decided to abandon my readers at the Post and hope that they'll become my voters for the Knesset. So I made Aliyah from the United States in 1991, 2 weeks after I graduated from Columbia. 6 weeks after I made Aliyah, I went into the Army. My family remained to this day, unfortunately, in the United States. So the entire process I went through alone, which was interesting and often difficult. I served for 5.5 years. I left as a captain. 15th of September, 1993, we had that infamous handshake between Rabin and Arafat on the White House lawn. During that time, I was working in the office of the coordinator of government activities in the territories. I was in a different job in the international organization's liaison. And then in early 1994, my commander, the coordinator for government activities in the territory, Rabin appointed him to be in charge of transfer civil administration powers to the PLO in Judea and Samaria. And he brought me into his office to coordinate all the negotiations with the Palestinians. So from May of 1994 through the end of 1996 when I left the army, so all of the major agreements that we did with the Palestinians, including the Hebron Protocol, I was a core member of Israel's negotiating team. I was also the only member of Israel's negotiating team that thought that the whole thing was a crock. At Columbia, I'd gotten a degree in international affairs, political science, and I took a lot of seminars on international agreements, treaty writing, international law. So a day or two before the Declaration of Principles became the first agreement that was signed in Oslo, became public, I was called in very late at night to the headquarters of the unit I was in. And they put me in a secure room that I had to translate this super secret document and give it to this brigadier general, who didn't speak English well. I was only allowed to bring in a pencil. They didn't want any digital record of what I was reading. But it was an executive summary of the Declaration of Principles. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the dumbest thing I ever read. I gave them the translation. I'm going home. And this was a totally secret document. And it was like the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news on the radio. And the anchor of the news on the radio started reading word for word what I had just written. So much for the secret negotiations. We were going to Cairo every week for these negotiating sessions with the Palestinians. And each week there seemed to be another terror attack, and we would go home early. There was one attack that really, I think, made the most impact on me, which was that a year later, in the summer of 1995, we were negotiating the Oslo II agreement. And I was 24, and it was in July. So it was sort of at the height of the negotiations. And it was the one week that we had the negotiations in the center of Israel. We had always had the negotiations in Cairo or in Taba or in Eilat, far away from the public. And this one week, they decided to have the negotiations in Zichron Yaakov. And I was living in North Tel Aviv at the time. And negotiations started on Sunday. And on Friday, there was a terrible terrorist attack. There were two young hikers, 19 and 20, Ori Shachor. And negotiations started on Sunday. And on Friday, there was a terrible terrorist attack. There were two young hikers, 19 and 20, Ori Shachor and Oad Bachrach, who were hiking in Wadi Kelb. And they were massacred. And their killers ran away to Jericho. They were either at the time or afterwards officers in the Palestinian security services. So these are the people that I'm negotiating with, right? I'm sitting across the table with these people who are engineering this big lie. They're supposed to be our friends, our partners in peace, and yet these two young men were butchered by their murderers who then ran to them for refuge and they received it. Israel ended up only putting its hands on them during Operation Defensive Shield in 2002. So from 1995 to 2002, not only were they running free, but they were operating as officers in the Palestinian security services that we were arming and training and legitimizing and working with. So Sunday comes, and I'm driving to Zichron Yaakov, and I see that there are all these cars with these signs on their windshields that say, Rabin Peres Seulaat, Rabin Peres Go Slow. And I just started to cry.
Hear what that's about after the break.
In a time where feelings have become fact, where rational thought and common sense has disappeared, one man stands above it all.
I'm Howie Sobiker, your political hitman.
Political Hitman airs every Tuesday at 11:59 p.m. North American time, 7 a.m. Israeli time, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On The Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Here is Walter Bingham.
And I see that there are all these cars with these signs on their windshields that say, Rabin Peres Seulaat, Rabin Peres Go Slow. And I just started to cry. Where are you going, Carolyn? Look what happened on Friday. I get there. Protesters were arriving around the same time I was, and I walked in the lobby, and I saw there Uri Sevier, who was the director general of the foreign ministry, and the generals that were running the various committees sitting there, and Uri is speaking in a very derogatory manner about the extremists and the messianics who are outside screaming and telling them to go slow. And I'm sort of in the state of suspended animation. I'm an officer in the IDF, a member of the negotiations. My commanders are laughing at the people outside, speaking derisively about them, calling them crazy fanatics and extremists. And I'm thinking, you have it exactly backwards. What they're saying is absolutely correct. We have to go slow. Look at who we're meeting with. Look at what they're doing. We know that they were just drafted into the Palestinian Security Services and that they ran away to Jericho. They didn't even bother to hide it. And it's contempt. So I'm thinking to myself, I want to be with the sane people instead of stand in the lobby with the crazy people. And the crazy people are in charge of the country. I'm not even 25, and I'm alone. My family's in Chicago. If I stay here, what am I doing here? And I said to myself, Carolyn, you didn't put yourself here. It was by such a strange fluke that you ended up being put into these negotiations to begin with. But you're here. Maybe God put you here. You have to just understand, Siddha, if you're here, you have to be the voice of the people outside trying to make them go slow and trying to be a break on this enthusiasm for giving away the store to the people who just sent these butchers out to kill our young boys. That was the epiphany that I had that day, and just took it upon myself to find out as much as I could about the dangers of what we were talking about. I used to drive on my own into Judea and Samaria on my days off to try to figure out arguments for why not to give things away. You know, I couldn't talk to anybody, obviously. It was all classified, except that it was all in the news. But that epiphany that I took, that moment, has really kind of been the lodestar that has been guiding my actions ever since, which is that you don't know why it is that you're put where you're put, whether it was in the prime minister's office during Netanyahu's first tenure, or when I went back to the United States to get a master's at the Kennedy School at Harvard, or when I went into journalism and I wrote, or when I wrote my book. I just said, do your best. It's not all about you, but all of us have a responsibility to do what we can to try to protect this country. Like it says, you know, in Pirkei Avot, lo alecha mamlacha ligmor, ach lo ata ben chorin itpater mimeno. It's not up to you to finish building the kingdom, but you're not allowed to walk away from building it. It's our responsibility too. So if you're put in these positions, then you have to do what you can to secure this country. And that's how I always felt in my writing. And I'll tell you another story, which brings me closer to why I went into politics. My book, The Israeli Solution, A One-State Plan for Peace in the Middle East, which gives the argument for applying Israeli law to Judea and Samaria. And in the summer of 2014, we went to war in Gaza in Protective Edge. So what people weren't aware of so much here was that the Obama administration was effectively siding with Hamas against Israel. They were demanding that Israel accept Hamas' ceasefire terms from the get-go. You know, Kerry was meeting with Hamas's emissaries from Qatar and Turkey and insisting that Israel bow to their demands. And Netanyahu, I have to say, in one of the most stunning successes of his career as a statesman, was able to maneuver very quickly and build an ad hoc alliance with the Saudis, the UAE, and Egypt. And that was how we were able to continue to fight and not accept their demands. But one of the things that the Obama administration did to apply pressure on Israel was they closed the airspace over Ben Gurion Airport, if you remember. So that happened the day before I had to go to Washington in a trip that was supposed to be 3 days of briefing senators and congressmen and doing some public speaking on the Hill about the book. And I did a lot of briefings and a lot of work on the Hill. And it was Senator Cruz, really, who came out and said he was going to put a hold on all administration nominations until they opened the airspace. And then after 36 hours, they opened it. But I was pretty proud of myself after that trip to Washington. It made me really start to think for the first time in many years that it might make sense for me to go back into the public arena and not just be a columnist and work in think tank, but actually get into politics and think about how to implement some of the ideas that I've been writing about all these years, first, you know, and foremost regarding the Palestinians, but not only. And I thought to myself, well, how would I do that? I've been out for so many years, and do I really want to do that? And so I thought, you know what, if you're going to go into politics, if it seems to make sense that you'll be able to do more for this country in whatever it is that they offer you, then you'll do it. And you know, my kids are also a little bit older. They're 7 and 9. A while back, Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked contacted me, and they asked if I'd be interested in joining them and their party and running for Knesset with them. And I thought this might be the opportunity. I've known Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked separately and together for over a dozen years. And really, since they entered politics, one of the things that has impressed me most is that they agree with me on most things. So a whole host of issues. That's one thing. But also that they've really managed to take the authority that they've been able to garner, the powers that they've received from voters, and translate it into implementing actual right-wing policies on the ground. The Likud and the right have won most of the elections since 1997, and yet in so many different spheres of government activities, our policies reflect the positions of the left and not of the right. I mean, the most obvious, glaring example is Sharon in 2003, but there are so many others. So we need leaders who are capable of changing the rules of the game, because the rules of the game were written by Mapai.
Israel's original Labor Party.
And Likud came in and kept playing by those rules. And if you accept that, then you're never going to get anywhere. You know, the thing that distinguishes Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked from other leaders is that they don't accept those rules. And they change them. And they have an idea of where Israel is supposed to be, which I agree with. And they've been moving forward in their positions to implement policies that reflect the direction that Israel should be going in. So when they asked me to join them in the Knesset, I thought, these are my kind of people. So I said, yes. It's my conviction that our party, Hayamin HaChadash,
the new right,
must be the strongest coalition partner in the next coalition. I think that it's fairly clear from all of the polls that the only party that's going to be able to form the next government is the Likud, because the Gantz, Lapid party and the left, they don't have 61 mandates. So they can't form a government, which means that the only person who's going to form a government after April 9th is Prime Minister Netanyahu. And then the question becomes, well, what government is he going to form? Is he going to form a government like he did in 2009 with Ehud Barak and let 1,000 terrorists out of jail and give the Bar-Ilan speech and keep us on this Oslo merry-go-round from Elm Street? Or like he did in 2013 with Tzipi Livni and go on the peace train with Obama and Kerry and freeze buildings? Or is he going to form a right-wing coalition government that's going to get us off the Oslo train? It's becoming acute now because we know that the Trump plan is going to come out probably while we're trying to form the next government. So the obvious play here is for him to form a unity government of sorts with Gantz and Lapid that's going to keep us on the Oslo merry-go-round. And the only way that we can get off of it is if the group, if the bloc of right-wing parties is sufficiently strong to force Netanyahu's hand to be a counter-pressure against him. You have the American Jewish community pushing him to get back on the fake peace train with the murderers. Or are we going to have a right-wing government with the Yamin HaChadash as the major partner in this coalition, pushing us forward, pushing us away from past mistakes and saying, we've had enough empowering of terrorists. We're not going to do this anymore. We can't give away any land. We're done with that. We have to apply Israeli law to Area C. We have to secure Israel's strategic and our national interest, finally, in Judea and Samaria, and the military government, apply Israeli law so that 500,000 Israelis are not living under military rule anymore. We have to secure our eastern frontier along the Jordan Valley. We can't have this anymore in question. Are we going to be there tomorrow or not? Yes, we are. We're not going to leave. And the only way that we can do that is with a strong right-wing coalition, with the Yamin HaChadash being the blocking back, pushing and ensuring that Netanyahu does what he believes in. No partition of Jerusalem, no terror state that's capable of actually paralyzing civilian airline traffic to Israel because they'll have Ben Gurion Airport in their rifle sights. These are the things that we have to ensure. We know where Benny Gantz stands on these issues. He thinks that we should just reenact the disengagement in Judea and Samaria. He said it in his opening speech. And Ofer Shelach from Yesh Atid today said he didn't see anything wrong with having the Arabs being the partners in the next government. So these are very different perspectives on where Israel should be heading. And these elections are critical to ensuring that we finally move forward. And I believe that Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked and Naftali Bennett, the Education Minister, have proven through their actions in the past government that they have a vision for that. They understand that we have to change the way that this game of politics is played in this country. And it's essential that we have as large a Knesset faction as possible, because the more we have, the more we can do to secure Israel for the future and not keep making the mistakes that we've been suffering from so much for the past 25 years. they had a very clear vision for what they were hoping to do with religious Zionism, because there's no reason for religious Zionists to be a sector. You know, Ayelet is a secular Israeli, and Naftali is religious, and they came together as a team to show that the commonality between Israelis from all across the secular religious divide is much greater than what separates us. And they were hoping to bring that basic insight into the way that things are done in Israel and how Israelis perceive ourselves as Jews to the National Religious Party. And it wasn't possible, not because people are bad. It wasn't possible because the Beit Yehudi,
the Jewish Home Party, which Bennett and Shaked left to form their own,
is a living, breathing institution. And it has institutional interests. And it has institutional attachments to rabbis, to very sectoral-based prism through which they see affairs in Israel. And it, as a practical matter, impossible to make that be a repository for all Israelis. Because not all Israelis can feel represented by a party when they're voting for people who aren't actually making the decision. And they didn't vote for Rabbi Drukman, with all due respect. Are we going to just accept things, or do we want to keep going with our vision of having a party that is pure ideologically right, that is Jewish, it's right-wing, and Israeli, and that this is what we believe in, and we want to take it. We don't want to cut corners. We're not going to allow a Palestinian state to be established, period. We're not going to have either religious coercion or secular coercion in Israel, because we don't believe in legislating social policies. We believe in living them as Jews in the Jewish state. That's the vision that animates our party. And it was a vision that they were hoping to instill in the Beit Yehudi.
If you will annex Area C, what happens to the Arabs who live there?
We have to give permanent residency status to the Palestinians and give them a path to citizenship, enable them to apply for citizenship. But there are criteria that people have to abide by before they can receive citizenship. The thing with Area C that I think is very important to recognize, how you look at the map or how you don't look at the map is almost not important in two following senses. First of all, Area C is over 50% of Judea and Samaria. It includes all of the eastern frontier of Israel. We're connecting the Jordan Valley, the frontier with Jordan, to the Sumerian mountains in the north and the South Judean hills in the south, and it provides the depth that we need in order to block invasion from the east. So from a strategic perspective, both in terms of whether it's an army or whether it's regular forces from Daesh or Al-Qaeda or wherever, or Hezbollah, we're able to block the approaches into our country by controlling those areas, which is critical. Absolutely critical. And then from a civilian perspective, let me tell you, you know, as a resident of Efrat for the past 3.5 years.
That's a fast-developing, sprawling town in the Judean Hills in Area C, south of Jerusalem.
You see just how ridiculous it is that you have 500,000 Israeli citizens living under military rule. The mayor of our town cannot decide how many school rooms we're going to have. We just have two new neighborhoods in Efrat, and we're building a third one, God willing. And so we're talking about transforming a small town of about 9,500 residents into a very large city with upwards of 20,000 in a very short period of time. Obviously, we needed a new school and more classrooms. But to do that, you have to get the permission not of the city council, but of the civil administration, and have the staff officer for education approve every single school room, which is insane. And you have a problem with property rights being protected, where we have right now incredible amounts of illegal Arab building all over the road leading up to the northern entrance to Efrat, which is supposed to serve thousands of families who are moving into these new neighborhoods. And they're going to have to drive across the gauntlet in order to get to Highway 60 to go into Jerusalem if we don't take care of it. The civil administration, they give the people stop work permit, and then they get the first chance and the second chance to appeal and the third chance to appeal. And then they can always petition to the High Court of Justice, and they never have to prove actual ownership of the illegal building sites where they're building without permit. So, you know, when I was in the negotiations with the Palestinians, the hardest negotiations we had were on planning and building. And we seriously constrained their ability to construct buildings without Israeli permission in Area C. And so they just tore up that agreement and started building everywhere they want to. And it's not just happenstance, it's always strategic. right? They want to choke at fraud. So they're building this, and our mayor doesn't have the ability to really do anything about it. It all has to be from the military. None of this is under Israeli law. We don't have the protections of our property the way that every other Israeli has. This has been going on for 51 years. And what our plan does is it protects the civil rights of Israeli citizens. So it's our strategic interest, our protected in the long term, and our ability to live in Judea and Samaria and grow our communities will also be protected and enabled and facilitated. These are important things. Now, regarding areas A and B, we don't talk a lot in our discourse in Israel about the dynamic situation on the ground in the Palestinian Authority. We look at it and we see it the way it has been in the past and not the way that it is today. Today, Abu Mazen, who is a dictator, but what does he control? Nothing. He doesn't even control Ramallah. If you recall the recent terror attacks against Netzach Yehuda and against the young woman who was pregnant outside of Ofra, they were carried out from terrorist groups operating from Ramallah. He's not in control of Hebron. He's not in control of Jenin. He's not in control of Beit Lechem. They're all going down to these local leaderships, devolving. And now with the United States defunding the Palestinian Authority and defunding UNRWA, for the first time since 1993, they actually lack the means to continue with this racket. So a lot of things are changing on the ground. One of the things that hasn't changed is that we don't know how many Palestinians live there. Because the first thing that happened in 1997 after they formed the Palestinian Authority is they falsified their population data by at least 50%. And all of the subsequent population data have been based upon that initial falsified census produced in 1997. So the Israeli public is operating under the assumption that there are 3 million Arabs who live in Judea and Samaria, when an independent assessment of the Palestinian data that took place 14 years ago for the first time showed that they had inflated the population data by 50%. But the IDF continues to go by the Palestinian data and tell us that any application of Israeli law to any part of Judea and Samaria is an existential threat to Israel's Jewish character because there are simply too many Arabs and we cannot do anything with the territory because if we do, we'll become an apartheid state. And this is insane. So obviously, one of the most urgent actions that the next government has to do is carry out a full population survey of Judea and Samaria. And you don't have to put census takers on the ground knocking on doors. All you have to do is look at their electricity record, look at their cell phone data, and you can approximate to within a decimal point of the actual number of Palestinians living on the ground. And Israel has refused to do this basic step so that we can have a discourse because we don't have a clear policy, because we don't have somebody like Naftali Bennett in the defense ministry making these kinds of demands on the central command. If you don't have any demand from the government to take an action, why would they? Now, regarding citizenship, you have to accept the good with the bad. What you get for applying Israeli law to Area C is securing our strategic interests in perpetuity in terms of our ability to protect our eastern frontier, and this crazy situation where 500,000 Israelis are denied basic civil rights in areas that have been in existence now going on 3 generations, not to mention their centrality in our heritage as Jews. If at the end of the day you have some number of Palestinian Arabs in Area C who apply for and are eligible for Israeli citizenship and they get naturalized, I think that the price that you pay and the return that you get justify that action. That's our position.
So what should we do with Areas A and B? You mentioned it a few times, but you didn't elaborate how we should administer the Arabs who live there.
So the position of the Yamina Hadash party is that they should continue to exercise autonomous rule. The Palestinians have been under autonomous rule for 23 years. The Palestinian Authority was formed in Judea and Samaria in early 1996. All of this talk about the occupation is a lie, because 98% of the Palestinians who live in Judea and Samaria have been living under Palestinian cells since 1996. And yet we continue to pretend, along with our greatest detractors and enemies, that we're still in charge. The only people who live under Israeli military rule are residents of Area C, almost all of whom are Israelis. We live under occupation. We live under military government. Our civilian authorities are not empowered to govern the same way that everybody else's mayors are. Now, since they're already in charge, why should we take that away from them? At least in the short term. And the idea, I think, is to reintegrate the Palestinian economy in with the Israeli economy. the stupidest things that they did in the Oslo Agreement was that they tried to separate the two when they're intertwined. I mean, before peace, we actually had peace. Before peace, they had economic growth that topped Israeli growth year on year from 1967 to 1994 by 1%. So if we were growing at 3%, they were growing at 4%. But what we're seeing now, at least from Ambassador Friedman, is that one of the things that the Americans are looking into is trying to reintegrate. I think that that makes sense. We just have to see how to work it from a security perspective. I think one of the things that we've had problems with understanding is that we've been so poorly led by our military commanders in this, who have been so scope-locked on this two-state scenario that they haven't been able to see the forest from the trees for so many years. We lose sight of the fact that sometimes you just have to let life be life and not try to force everybody to act in some sort of preconceived ways. The Army's job is not to determine what people can and can't do. Their job is to ensure that whatever they do, we're safe. And that's the other reason why we have to end the military government. Because when you have officers making decisions about civil issues, which they really don't have any idea how to do, they have no expertise in it. They certainly don't have expertise any greater than that of elected officials and municipal authorities. They forget that their principal job is to defeat Israel's enemies.
Would your party join a government of Lapid and Gantz?
Do the math. Look at the numbers and recognize that there is no path to victory for the Gantz-Lapid ticket, that they cannot form a government. Then you have to ask the real question here. Are we going to have a unity government between Likud and Benny Gantz, Yair Lapid, that's going to jump through every hoop that the Trump deal of the century gives them? Or are you going to have a Netanyahu-Bennett-Shaked government that is going to be capable of saying no to Donald Trump if he tells us that he wants us to partition Jerusalem, if he tells us that he wants us to give away 90% of Judea and Samaria to the Palestinians to force some 100,000 Israelis who live outside of the so-called settlement blocks to pack up their bags and go home to be refugees in their country? If you don't want that to happen, then you have to ensure not that Likud is the largest party, but that the right-wing bloc is a blocking coalition that ensures that Israel is governed from the right. It's exceedingly important. The distinctions, the disparities between the Yamin HaChadash on the one hand and Gantz and Lapid on the other are very striking. Benny Gantz, in his first speech, Jerusalem is our united capital, but then he didn't say that it would remain united, and he didn't say that it wouldn't become somebody else's capital. He said the Jordan Valley is Israel's security border. What does that mean? Well, that's doublespeak for we're going to give it up and put warning systems at the border. We're going to throw all of the civilian communities that now exist in the Jordan Valley out, and they'll put together an international force that'll be just as credible as every other international force along our borders. We're talking about a very, very large distinction between the character of the governments that can potentially be formed after April 9th. We have been on this merry-go-round of Oslo for too long, but each time that we finally think we're going to get out of this and this nightmare with the PLO, we keep getting put back on coalition politics, U.S. pressure, you name it. We're never getting off of it. We can never just move and apply Israeli law and put an end to the charade. To do that, we have to ensure that the right-wing bloc is at 68 or 69. The plan that the Yamin HaChadash is putting forward is not talking about naturalizing all of the Arabs in Judea and Samaria. What we're talking about is applying Israeli law to Area C and allowing the Palestinians who live in Area C, which is up to 100,000 people and not more, they are going to get permanent residency status and have the opportunity to apply to be naturalized. And if they abide by the criterion of Israeli citizenship law, then they may be naturalized in the next 5 to 10 years.
That's the subject on which we could build a whole program. But let's move on to another part of your party's platform, which is to make it all inclusive.
I'm raising my kids Orthodox. They're in religious schools, and my husband's Orthodox. I'm on the spectrum because I think that I'm just a Jew. And what we find in Israel is that there is a very large majority of Israelis who are on the spectrum. And the slogan of our party is Yehudi Israeli. You're not going to see a lot of Israelis running around saying, well, it's not important to me to be Jewish. society has changed in so many wonderful ways. And one of the ways that it's changed so much is that people who back in the 1990s were telling me, oh, I'm Israeli, it's not that important to me to be Jewish, are now saying, their kids are saying, most important thing to me is to be Jewish and Israeli is second. So that's a big switch. And this, again, goes back to why did they leave the Jewish home party, start the Mina Chadash? It's because there are a lot of people in Israel who feel this way about our country and who feel this way about who we are as Jews. And they need a party that's not going to compromise, that's not going to cut corners, that's going to actually represent them, that's actually going to enact policies that reflect our values as Israelis, as Jews, and as right-wingers, that we need this voice in Knesset. We need it to be strong, we need it to be clear, and we need it to implement actual policies on the ground so that we can move forward as a people. And so we're talking to a lot of non-religious audiences, and also a lot of religious audiences. You know, all these years that I've been writing, I always am getting these comments saying, oh, you're preaching to the choir. If you don't preach to the choir, they won't come to church. Why should we sell ourselves short? Why should we say that somebody else is more important? No, we're the people. And we need a government that represents us and reflects our values. We need to be proud of who we are and of our sanity and of our commitment to our people and our country and take this country forward. If you want to move your country forward, you have to vote for a party that has a vision for where this country is supposed to go that you can attach yourself to. We have a vision for where we want this country to go. We've already seen Ayelet Shaked and Naftali Bennett in action and changing the way that things are done in this country on so many different levels, on a path to achieving progress that's going to secure our future and our posterity. That the Yamina Chadash is not at 7 or 8 mandates, but at somewhere between 12 and 18 mandates, so that we're able to actually be the senior partner in this coalition. And we have to have your support.
In Israel, it's not a week, but a single day that is a long time in politics. Caroline Glick's optimism for a large right-wing bloc no longer looks as certain as when she spoke about it last week. According to the latest polls, the Ganz Lapid blue-white left-wing bloc is fast catching up. In fact, according to some polls, has overtaken Netanyahu's right-wing bloc. Of course, the only poll that counts is the election on April the 9th. Judging by the speech of General Gantz at the official launch of his party, he would, if Prime Minister, have little hesitation to sacrifice our security by cooperating with a plan of Trump and surrendering territory. By the way, it's worth mentioning that Lieutenant General Gantz was the chief of staff at the time of Operation Protective Edge, the 2014 Gaza war, which achieved nothing and left the Hamas machinery in control and brought us extensive rocket fire from Gaza. Therefore, this is the time when every patriotic voter who wants to maintain Israel as a Jewish state must turn out to vote for one of the right-wing parties. It's time for me now to vacate this seat, but I hope to be back again next week with more from Israel and the rest of the Jewish world. Until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good week, and I cannot say it often enough that it's your duty to make sure that your elderly neighbor is not neglected. Goodbye.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas. now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Torres from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.